The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting for Mr. Stephen Flurry. He is on his way to Austria right now. So I'm sure that he is super disappointed that he can't be here with you and is instead on his way to one of the most beautiful parts of the entire planet. Now, we usually start this show talking about some of the biggest, some of the most important news of the day. The stories that are really going to change the world, that are going to impact your life. So today, I'd like to start by talking about my dishwasher. Now, don't get me wrong, I like my dishwasher. There's something odd about dishwashers in the UK and Europe. For just about any other kitchen appliance, the models that you get in America are bigger and better. Especially washing machines and tumble dryers, but for some reason America seems terrible at making dishwashers. You seem to like you have to clean everything before they go in an American dishwasher. My dishwasher, on the other hand, it's generally pretty good, but there's one thing that really, that is a little annoying about it, that kind of niggles, and that is that on the default cycle, it takes about 2.5 hours. 2.5 hours to do a full cycle. That's a pretty ridiculous amount of time for just cleaning a bunch of dishes. Now, it's not a huge problem. Press a few buttons and it will clean it much quicker. But who in their right mind makes a dishwasher that takes 2.5 hours to clean? Well, this isn't just a random rant about something that annoys me about my dishwasher, because this long dishwasher cycle is the fault of the European Union. To quote bestdishwasher.co.uk, a site that, as I'm sure you know, we quote all the time on this program, for bestdishwasher.co.uk, the changes in the wash cycles and the length of time that they run for can be directly attributed to what many see as the ever-meddling EU, who have set out some pretty stringent guidelines for dishwasher manufacturers. And that's why today we're starting off by talking about my dishwasher. It's a tiny thing, really, but it just illustrates how far the EU has reached into the everyday lives of people in Britain. And it's not just dishwashers. This just scratches the surface. Here's a clip from a movie called Brexit the Movie that explains just how far the EU's reach is.
You've got thousands and thousands of bureaucrats, civil servants and administrators. And their job is to push paper, write on paper, have rules on paper, pile up more and more paper. You just get a mass of growing telephone directory size rules and regulations, one after the other, ceaselessly, endlessly. That is actually what the bureaucracy sees itself as there to do.
If the list of EU rules could be put into one document today, it would take more than two men to carry it on. Such a document would reach as high as Nelson's Column. Regulation is so vast and complex, even the EU is unable to tell us how many laws there are covering different areas of our lives. So we've used some helpful EU databases to make the best estimate we can. Here is regulated EU man waking from his regulated slumber to start his regulated day. You wouldn't think you'd need a law for pillowcases, but the EU has 5. But that's nothing. The pillow inside is subject to 109 different EU laws. As far as we can tell, there are only 11 EU laws pertaining to radio alarm clocks. There's around 400 governing the other stuff on Joe Citizen's bedside table. You can't be too careful with duvets and sheets, so there's around 50 laws governing those. There are 65 laws governing bathrooms, but that doesn't include the contents. How they managed to think up 31 laws for toothbrushes is beyond me. But let's face it, toothpaste is a bit weird, so 47 laws sounds about right. Mirrors have been known to crack and get dirty, so they're covered by 172 laws. As for the shower, well, we've all seen Psycho. Murdering girls like that is now strictly prohibited. Shampoo can get in your eyes and cause discomfort, 118 laws. EU bureaucrats seem terrified by towels for some reason. Slightly more relaxed about radiators. There are 1,246 laws relating to bread, but just 52 covering the crazy anarchic toaster. Just 84 laws cover fridges. But an impressive 12,000 laws cover milk. After all, it might go off. Bowl, 99 laws. Spoon, more than 200 laws, same for the orange juice. But the coffee, whoa, stand back, Grandma. This toxic jungle juice can keep you up all night. The best dog in Britain is unaware of the odourless fog of canine legislation, but careful, Ruby, ignorance is no excuse. Our regulated man leaves his regulated house. There are only 92 laws about pavements, after all, they're just pavements, but you get the idea. EU regulation surrounds us like invisible barbed wire. When we're frustrated in our daily lives by needless, stupid EU laws, it's infuriating. But it's much worse than infuriating if you're thinking of starting a new business. It's like entering a legal minefield.
For small and medium-sized businesses and startups, it's perilous. Complying with regulation imposes huge costs, and falling foul of regulation can put you out of business.
That's really a shocking clip from Brexit the movie. And you don't get everything from just the audio. The video that goes with that was also pointing out a ton more regulations as to kind of the narration went on. For example, over 400 EU regulations on towels. A towel is a piece of cloth. You could use a T-shirt as a towel, but 400 regulations on towels. I don't think you can get anything quite as much more basic than a towel. 1,500 regulations on roads. And so the EU literally dominates our lives. Every product we use is subject to these different laws, has been changed because of these different laws. And the vast majority, you know, they don't know just how deeply the EU is involved in our lives over here, how widespread it is, how powerful it is. And unless you kind of dig into these things and know these things, you know, you might be frustrated by your dishwasher, but you don't make the connection to the EU. You don't know that that comes from the EU. And you know, the reason I mentioned at the start, kitchen appliances don't tend to work as well over here as they do in America. And the big reason for that is the EU. You know, for example, they decide that they want energy efficient tumble dryers. And the whole way that they kind of work and think is they try and create energy efficient tumble dryers by fiat. They pronounce a law putting a maximum ceiling on how much energy a tumble dryer can use. And to them, that's it. Problem solved. The result is that unless you shop around very carefully, you end up with a low-power tumble dryer that doesn't dry things very well. So then what do? Well, you put the tumble dryer on for a second cycle to dry your clothes properly because you want dry clothes. And so all those EU good intentions about saving electricity have been proven absolutely useless because now you're using a tumble dryer that doesn't work and needs 2-3 times more cycles to clean anything or to dry anything. And so the EU has succeeded in absolutely nothing apart from being annoying. And so in just this is just small examples, you see so much about the EU. You know, this idea that bureaucrats, that unelected experts, they know better than ordinary people, that's just really built into its DNA. And they just try and fix everything that they see as being a problem with rules, with regulations. And it doesn't work, you know, even to the point that they think, well, we can't trust the ordinary people to buy the right kind of tumble dryer or washing machine or dishwasher. Therefore, we need to pass dozens or hundreds, in many cases, of laws to force people to buy the type of tumble dryer that we, the EU all-knowing bureaucrats, want them to buy. One of my favorite quotes on economics comes from the economist F.A. Hayek. And he said, the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. The economy is huge, it's complicated, and these experts simply aren't capable of planning things and making it work. And so you just end up with a mess. As a slight digression, Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, makes a lot of great and kind of scary predictions about the future of the EU. Something I'd probably like to get into on a different show. Hayek's whole approach to economics was really very good, and he was probably one of the most eloquent opponents of the debt-based economic system that we have today. And then The Road to Serfdom, he talks about how well-meaning planners try to fix things by passing laws and regulating the economy, but it fails. We're just not capable humanly of planning an entire economy. You know, there's nobody in Britain who could sit down and predict exactly how many tubes of toothpaste the nation should manufacture this year. It doesn't work. They make things worse. Eventually, people get so frustrated, they put in place a strongman who promises to fix everything. And this strongman can become a dictator very quickly because the planners have already started trying to regulate and control every aspect of people's lives. That's his book, The Road to Serfdom, in a nutshell. But back to the EU, you know, all of these nonsensical and annoying rules, that they reach into every aspect of our lives. And as it says in that video, it's annoying for us. It's a nightmare for small businesses. How do you... Bread. I mean, it should be simple to start up a business making bread. But nope, you've got to conform to, I think it was 1,200, something like that, regulations on bread. And I wanted to start here because it vividly shows and demonstrates just how powerful the EU is and how deep its reach is. It affects everybody in Britain's daily lives, though the vast majority don't realize that. Has it been a good thing? Has that deep, that vast EU influence been a good thing? That is a key question. Now, Britain will vote on its place in the European Union in just a few weeks. June 23rd is the referendum date. It's all over the news over here right now. So has Britain's EU membership been a good thing? Well, when Britain joined the EU, or what was to become the EU back then, it was the European Economic Community, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Britain is going to look back on Monday, January 1st, 1973, in all probability as a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities, for that date marked the United Kingdom's entry into the European Community." Is he right? Or you can certainly see how much power it's given Europe over Britain. Now, I've been just in terms of looking at the power and the influence, the reach that Europe has over Britain, there have been all kinds of figures on how many of Britain's laws, what percentage of Britain's laws comes from the EU. It is huge. We'll play just a clip now from a recent BBC documentary called Paxman in Brussels, Who Really Rules Us? Paxman being the presenter. And we'll play that clip on how many EU laws impact Britain now.
There wasn't a word about bananas when we first applied to join the EEC. But in the years since, more and more laws made here have come to Britain. How many? It'd be nice to know. This chap thinks he knows.
Look, you'll hear from Nigel Farage say, 75% of our laws. No, actually, the House of Commons has shown that roughly 7% of all new laws are related to the European Union.
Oh, dear.
And so does this one.
We had one of your friends from Brussels, Commissioner Vivian Reding, in London the other week, saying we must all sign up to United States of Europe and we must recognise the importance of Brussels because, after all, it makes 70% of our laws. Even Gordon Brown said over half our laws are made in Brussels.
So what's the number really?
It depends what you count. Is it just directives in which the European Union tells Parliament what it needs to do? Or do you include regulations? Is it one or both?
The House of Commons Library tried to tot up the numbers in various combinations, coming up with an estimate between 15% and 55%. But when they looked at figures for 2010 to 2013, the most recent available at the time, they calculated a whopping 59%.
There is a catch, inevitably. We get all the regulations, but some of them, like the production of olive oil or growing tobacco, clearly don't apply to us. So the figure of 59% may be a gross exaggeration. All the researchers conclude is that it is impossible to get an accurate measurement, which for some people tells you all you need to know about our relationship with the EU.
I agree. I think it does tell you all you need to know about our relationship with the EU. And so somewhere a little under 60% of our laws come from Brussels. That seems to be the best figure. But they're not even sure. We don't even know what percentage of our laws are dictated to us from unelected bureaucrats within the European Union. Britain joined a trading union, and now all of these laws are being handed down from Brussels. So going back to this question, has it been good for Britain here? You know, do all of these foreign bureaucrats, do they have Britain's best interests at heart? Has Britain benefited? And the Brexit movie, one of the most shocking parts of that, they did a short segment just on Britain's fishing industry, just one small industry. But I was just shocked at how much the EU had devastated just this one industry.
The reward for giving up our sovereignty, we're told, is greater influence in Europe. To see how much influence we have, I've come to the place I grew up. For centuries, fishermen's huts called Shields lined the River Tyne. From them came the names of the towns that straddled the mouth of the river, North and South Shields. The seas here are rough, but the water is rich in mackerel, haddock, salmon, herring, cod, skate and shrimp. By the early 20th century, 14,000 tons of fish a year was being landed here at North Shields.
When I started working down here, there was about 200 firms working on the quay. There was haulage firms on the quay who had 30 and 40 wagons that used to ship the fish away.
And how many boxes would there be in the market then?
In them days, 8, 10, 12, and then you would get all through, you get 1,000.
12,000 boxes a day?
Uh-huh.
So a different place?
You could have an X, man. You couldn't get moved. Now with this, well, I think the average for the year, it'll just be about 200 boxes a day. So it's quite nothing, isn't it? Yeah.
When Britain joined the common market, it lost control of its fishing grounds. When quotas were imposed, several other European countries lobbied the EU for Britain's fishing rights to be divided up between them. The British government was powerless to stop this.
The EU has just obliterated the English fishing industry altogether. The quota system they've got now is it's just mad.
Local fishermen were now banned from fishing in waters they'd fished successfully for centuries.
Again, you know, the audio is very powerful, but you miss a lot even not having the video, because it showed lots of videos of just these abandoned, empty buildings, empty quaysides, empty beaches that were once part of a huge industry. Completely devastated by the European Union. 12,000 boxes of fish a day down to 200. And that video went on to talk about just how many of these fishing grounds right up close to the British coast have now been taken over by people from foreign nations. And that's just one industry. So it's clear the EU does not have Britain's best interests at heart. Now, obviously, the EU hasn't been absolutely devastating to all of Britain's economy. We're still here. On the surface, the economy looks pretty good. When you dig deeper, there is a huge amount of debt, but you know, that's not the EU's fault. Britain certainly cannot blame all or even its most important problems on the European Union. Mr. Flory covered that earlier in the week. But the EU membership, it has hurt. It's devastated things like fishing, something that's been a huge industry for centuries. And again, just the other thing to remember about the fishing industry is a lot of this has happened in a lot of areas that have been economically devastated anyway by other developments. Areas where they have high unemployment anyway. They had high unemployment due to the collapse of a lot of Britain's heavy industry, collapse of coal mining, this kind of thing. And so for the fishing industry for the North Sea generally was up north. And so it's just hit areas that were already struggling, already deprived. And it has made a big difference to those communities, to those industries. So I don't want to certainly downplay fishing. But what hurts far more than how the EU has hurt the economy, at least to me personally, or in my mind, is the loss of sovereignty. Britain has been signing away the power to run its own country to a group of unelected officials in Brussels. Britain has had a lot of freedom. It has had a pioneering history with the rule of law. It's benefited from the least worst kind of government that mankind has ever invented, as Churchill called democracy. But it's giving up so much of that power, again, as that Brexit movie brought out.
The curious thing is, only last year we were celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, the founding charter of English freedom. The history of democracy in Britain has been the history of taxpayers demanding the right to determine themselves how much tax should be taken from them and how it should be spent.
If I'm going to be asked to pay taxes, I want to be told where they're going, and if they're spent badly or stupidly, I want to be able to remove from power the people who are spending them.
What made Britain rather different from most other countries was that at an early stage, we said no government could pass any law or impose any tax without first getting the authority of the British people. So it's a major thing that we can be taxed by other people without our say.
We are now subjects of a vastly complex state machine run by anonymous officials whom we didn't elect, but who have the power to impose on us laws that we haven't debated and have no democratic means of repealing.
People who say to you that the European Union is undemocratic fundamentally misunderstand the European Union. It is anti-democratic.
Anti-democratic. And as that short segment brought out, if European unelected officials pass a law that the British people don't like, there is nothing they can do to get rid of it. The Prime Minister can't get rid of it. Britain's MEPs in the European Parliament, they can't get rid of it. The European Parliament does not have the power to overrule these unelected bureaucrats. It does not have the power to overturn one of their decisions. So when the EU passes a law that we don't like, we can do nothing. And I think that's where the vast majority or a lot of the frustration with the European Union comes from. There is nothing that we can do to overturn things that we don't like. Now, on this program yesterday, Mr. Flurry talked about some of the reasons for America's greatness, or touched on that as part of his subject there. And Britain and America, they became great nations because they were blessed by God. But one of the ways they were blessed was through their form of government and organizing themselves. It's not been perfect, but they've been some of the best systems that you can have when you have a man ruling over man. But now Britain is abolishing those systems of rules, that way of governing that God gave the nation, that allowed the nation had to have, that allowed it to become great. They're abolishing it. They're getting rid of that way of rulership. Then they're handing over power to Europe. And that's all pretty terrible as an Englishman. It makes me angry. But the loss of sovereignty, that wasn't the main thing that Mr. Armstrong was pointing to when he wrote that Britain is going to look back on Monday, January 1st, 1973 as a most tragically historic date. Instead, that statement was related to a much bigger problem with Britain's relationship to the European Union. We'll take a quick break now, and we'll get back to that problem after the break.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity. and our ancestry. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
The war had left Germany little more than smoking rubble. West Germany would receive some martial aid, but only less than half the amount sent to Britain.
At the end of the Second World War, Germany was a ruin. If you see the old footage, it was absolutely flattened.
Germany needed a miracle, and this was the man who performed it. In the first free elections after the war, Ludwig Erhard, the son of a shopkeeper, became Minister for the Economy, a post he held until 1963.
Ludwig Erhard began the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle, by completely scrapping all of the controls that he'd inherited from the Third Reich, and he did this against the strong advice of his British superiors, you might say, in the occupied zone.
Erhard revolutionised the German economy because he just got rid of regulations on a massive scale. He got rid of production controls, price controls, he got rid of trade barriers.
They were happy to have open and free trade, a deregulated economy. They want to see industries stand on their own two feet, and those that can't must make way for those that can.
Germany was open to the world. You had much more free and easy entry into business and commerce and the professions in Germany. And the result was that the German economy became much more dynamic, much more innovative, and ultimately much, much more successful.
Just look how quickly Germany pulled itself off the floor.
Industrial production soared.
In Britain, there were shortages and rising prices. In Germany, goods were abundant and wages rose steeply.
The result for the ordinary person in Germany was sensational, because the production of all consumer goods rose, the prices came down. Britain, who won the war, was still rationed for year after year after year, whereas Germany, who lost the war, rationing was abolished.
Before you know it, just a decade or two of this approach, and it's a powerhouse of Europe.
Contemporaries described it as a miracle. By the time Erhard left office, he had transformed Germany from a pile of smoking ruins to the third biggest economic power in the world.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 on the FM dial at broadcasting out of Edmond, Oklahoma, or on kpcg.fm. This program is going live from our studio in Edstone near Stratford-upon-Avon in England. That's a clip Mr. Flurry played on the Trumpet Daily Radio a few weeks ago from Brexit the movie. Now, if you're just joining us, we spent the first half talking about my dishwasher. Just kidding, we've been talking about Brexit and how deeply the EU reaches into our lives with its regulations covering everything from dishwashers to bread and washing machines, how it's destroyed the fishing industry, how it controls Britain, how much power and sovereignty Britain has handed over to the EU, and how damaging it's been to Britain. And we've been talking in the first segment about a statement Mr. Armstrong made about how Britain is going to look back on that date that it joined the EU as a most tragically historic date. But what was the danger that he was warning about? Well, before I get there, I want to play just one more clip from Brexit the movie. And we just heard a clip from Germany there and Germany's economic miracle at the start of this segment. And here's what came shortly after that clip in Brexit the movie.
Then came something called the common market.
In the greatest free trade experiment of modern times, the barriers are going up between six European countries. Barriers up, tariffs down. That is the meaning of the common market, formed by France, Italy, Western Germany, with Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. they will reduce and eventually abolish trade barriers between themselves and at the same time maintain a common tariff against the world outside.
Joining the EEC seemed like a great idea. It meant escaping the dismal, dreary confines of post-war Britain.
In the 70s, we had terrible problems. We had double-digit inflation, the three-day week, prices and incomes policies, and we looked across the Channel and we thought, these chaps are doing something right.
At that time, Britain was a very centralised place, a very over-bureaucratic and regulated place. Europe was a much more competitive and free-trading place, and it looked like the future. Europe was the future.
Europe meant sun and wine and fancy food like pasta. It meant going out into the world and opening up and hopefully becoming more like powerhouse Germany.
So Britain's economy was really struggling after the war. Germany was prospering. And so we, Britain, looked to Germany for help with our problems and joined the European Union. Now compare what those couple of clips, what we just listened to what Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1962 when Britain first started negotiating to join the EU. And he wrote in an article, "Now notice the prophecy about Britain going to Germany for help in her present economic plight instead of relying on God. Remember, Ephraim is Britain today, Assyria is Germany." And then a bit further down he wrote, "Ephraim allows himself to be mixed up with foreigners, says God." Hosea 7, verse 8, Moffat translation. Yes, Britain is allowing itself to get mixed in with European foreigners, even negotiating to desert her own Commonwealth nations by 1970. In her economic distress right now, Britain is not seeking God's help, nor relying on him to restore prosperity. She is going to the common market, undoubtedly to be dominated by Germany. Continue the King James Version. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. Marginal translation, understanding. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. Hosea 7, verse 11. And Mr. Armstrong writes, Britain is now going to Germany and the Six for help instead of going to the eternal God and seeking him. Now, when was this to take place? Mr. Armstrong continues. And what is to happen as a result? Continue the next verse. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down. I will chastise them. Woe unto them, for they have fled from me, God says to Britain today. And that's Hosea 7, verses 12 to 13. Mr. Armstrong continues, these prophecies do not say necessarily that Britain will be admitted to actually join the common market. They show merely that instead of trusting their God, the British are begging help from the Germans. Although ancient Israel did seek alliances with Assyria, prophecy is dual, and these prophecies do apply to the present. History does truly repeat itself. So as Mr. Armstrong explained there, Britain to look to Europe for the solution to its problems. Now, Europe didn't cause Britain's problems, and there is huge room for debate about how many of Britain's problems today are as a result of Europe. As we mentioned in the first half, Europe certainly has caused problems. But there are plenty of self-inflicted problems as well. But Europe certainly has not solved Britain's problems. So Britain gave up so much of its system of rules and laws that God had given the nation that helped make the nation great. Britain gave them away. It gave up the Commonwealth, the last remains of that God-given empire. And instead, Britain looked to Europe for solutions. But looking to Europe for solutions is dangerous. Why? Well, to start answering that, here's a quick segment from a message Mr. Armstrong gave on Europe and the rise of Europe in the 1980s.
But now, why the delay? I have known for years, and you've heard me proclaim again and again and again, that the United States of Europe is coming. They're going to unite 10 nations in Europe. And the Vatican will be on top of the heap. Why has it not happened? 49 years have gone by. At last I can tell you that it is, all the pieces are falling into place now, all of a sudden. Well, in Europe, there are many nations, they speak different languages. They're divided by various languages. They're divided by different national aspirations and national patriotisms. and by different currencies. They have the German mark, the French franc, the English pound, and the lira in Italy, and the pesos, peso or whatever it is in Spain. They have different kind of currency, different kind of money. Now they have gotten together in an economic system. That's been going on now for a good many years. The EEC, or the European Economic Community. But that is only something that knocks down tariff barriers for the for international trade among the nations of Europe. But what they want is political union. What they want is one military force. What they want is one great world power.
So that's what so many or many of these leaders want in Europe, a military force, to be a great world power. And as Mr. Armstrong said, there are 10 nation superpower is coming from Europe. Now, for centuries, Britain has known that if Europe is united, if a power in Europe becomes too strong, if it can dominate the continent, then the nation's security, the nation's survival will be at stake. And so Britain put together several coalitions against Napoleon to try and stop him from dominating Europe. They fought the Sun King, Louis XIV. Then they defeated we defeated him so badly we had to switch sides and ally with France against the Holy Roman Empire to stop them from taking over. Right, here's a clip from a night from I think it was the 80s British comedy show Yes Minister that makes this point in a bit more of a humorous way.
The civil service was united in its desire to make sure that the common market didn't work. That's why we went into it.
What are you talking about?
Minister, Britain has had the same foreign policy objective for at least the last 500 years, to create a disunited Europe. In that cause, we have fought with the Dutch against the Spanish, with the Germans against the French, with the French and Italians against the Germans, and with the French against the Germans and Italians. Divide and rule, you see. Why should we change now, when it's worked so well?
Ancient history, surely.
Yes, and current policy. We had to break the whole thing up, so we had to get inside. We tried to break it up from the outside, but that wouldn't work. Now that we're inside, we can make a complete pig's breakfast of the whole thing. Set the Germans against the French against the Italians against the Dutch. The Foreign Office is terribly pleased. It's just like old times.
Surely we're all committed to the European ideal.
Really, Minister?
If not, why are we pressing for an increase in the membership?
Well, for the same reason. It's just like the United Nations, in fact. The more members it has, the more arguments it can stir up, the more futile and impotent it becomes.
What appalling cynicism.
Yes. We call it diplomacy, Minister.
Now, I don't think Britain really tried to break up the EU from the inside, but it makes the point. Britain has always feared a united Europe, and that's what British foreign policy has been about for the last many hundreds of years. But in this case, instead of opposing this European Economic Community, this effort for a united Europe, Britain joined it. And then they looked to Europe for help. They supported the rise of that European power. They wanted this we wanted this German-led power to solve our economic problems. And that is the real tragedy of Britain's EU membership. It helped create this European superpower. It trusted in this superpower instead of in God. And Britain's leaders have known for centuries, like I said, that a united Europe could destroy Britain and that and threaten Britain. And that is exactly what this rising power in Europe will do. Now, could Britain have avoided this by not joining the EU? Well, they could have avoided what's coming if we'd have looked to God instead of to the EU. But even if we'd not joined the EU back in the 70s, that union would have still risen and threatened Britain anyway. But we did put ourselves under the yoke of that rising power much earlier by joining. And what now? You know, could Britain fix this through Brexit, through leaving? Joseph de Courcy, he's one of the most insightful analysts out there. He often has some great insight, and he's published some really good articles. The trouble is he doesn't seem to write much these days. I had a look. I don't think I've had a single article from him in all this year. But so we have to make do with his occasional tweets. Yesterday was one of the rare days in every few months that he tweeted. And he tweeted, UK historic goal is to stop hostile power dominating Europe. Brexit would mean hostile EU whose first move would be to procure UK breakup. And he is right. If Britain leaves the EU, there's still going to be a fairly unified hostile power, or a fairly unified power in Europe that would be capable of harming Britain. And the rise of the EU means that Britain will face a hostile power in Europe. Now, I don't think staying in would necessarily improve the situation much. Britain would still face a hostile Europe. It'd just be easier for the EU to do things to harm the country. But the rise of this united power is a major, major threat to Britain. We'll take another quick break and we'll continue this discussion on the EU and how it threatens Britain after that.
This is KPCG-FM and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The people have never given a bigger vote of no confidence in Brussels.
Today, world markets were nervously watching.
The stock market has not been reassured.
What the European Union has become in the 21st century is what Britain was when it was the sick man of Europe.
Despite decades of economic decline, the EU elite carries on regardless. They are unmoved by criticism, untroubled by popular discontent. But the frustration of ordinary people is beginning to show.
We now have to focus on constructing a firewall to prevent contagion within the Eurozone.
What you can see everywhere is a conflict between the visions of a rather narrow kind of professional middle class, which has dominated European politics, and the reaction against it by the larger bulk of the European population.
Eventually, if you stuff dictatorship down the throats of people who don't want it, they will rebel.
Unfortunately, in many places, it's taking a very unpleasant form of right-wing populist nationalism.
Extremism at both ends is being fostered by the anti-democratic nature of the European Union.
What do we see? Far-right parties, ultra-nationalist parties.
We don't know what the future of Europe is going to look like, but at the moment it's not looking good. We don't know what political forces are going to rise in the future. We don't know what conflicts we might be dragged into.
Far from being it safer for us to be in the EU, there are dangers that go along with us being members of the EU, being dragged into situations we don't want to get in.
Marine Le Pen's far-right party came first, winning 25% of the vote.
Given the shocking lack of growth in the EU, the promises of prosperity and security seem empty.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That was another clip from Brexit, the movie, and today we have been talking about Brexit, Britain's role in the European Union. You're listening to KPCG on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, or on kpcg.fm for the live stream. Now, if Britain votes to leave or votes to stay, what's coming next? As we heard from that clip, Europe is in a very uncertain place right now. There's a lot of anger against the people in charge of the EU, a lot of protests. There's a lot of struggling economies. Where is this leading? Well, there are a lot of smart people saying the EU is not only failing, it's failed already, that the entire thing is going to fall apart or simply fade away to irrelevance. Now, is that true? In one way, yes. You know, the ones that say the EU will fall apart or will fade away, they're people like George Friedman, analysts that the Trumpet we tend to quote quite a bit. And one of the key things that makes analysts like Friedman so good is they do have some good and some accurate understanding of human nature. And they do see human nature as being fundamentally selfish. And it isn't in human nature to surrender control of your country to another country. Now, people will do that if they think that they will benefit, if they will get more prosperity. But once that stops, it's in human nature to blame foreigners for your problems. There are people behind the EU, there are some people, not all, but some behind the EU have tried to run it as a kind of a grand utopian project to give up their own people, to give up their own nations, become part of this greater European superstate. But to do that, they're working against human nature. So in that sense, the EU is destined to fall, to fail, to fall apart. Now, will it fall apart if Britain leaves? Or if Britain stays, will Britain so much division that it falls apart? Is Europe already so damaged that it's going to fall apart? Well, let's park that question for a second and look at another. Who rules Europe right now? Who dominates Europe? Consider these quotes from fairly recent news articles. This is a Spiegel, March 21st, 2015. An empire is in play, at least in the economic realm. The Eurozone is clearly ruled by Germany, though Berlin is not unchallenged. It does, however, have a significant say in the fate of millions of people from other countries. Then Stephen Green, The Telegraph, June 23rd, 2015. Germany finds itself at the geographic and economic centre, and therefore increasingly the political centre too, of the new Europe. No longer do all roads lead to Paris, but to Berlin. Peter Oborn, March 5th, 2015. This marks a vital turning point in the post-war world. Germany has long been the dominant economic power in the European Union. With Miss Merkel in charge, it is now turning that economic power into diplomatic power. Those are just three quotes I pulled out quickly. But Germany dominates Europe. And if Europe were to fall apart, the EU were to fall apart, as so many are forecasting, that's not going to change. And here's what Friedman wrote about Germany and Germany's position in Europe in his book Flashpoints. He writes, "The question of Europe now is again the question of Germany, or what it wants, what it fears, what it will and won't do. This is the oldest question of Europe. It goes along with the old. This is the old question of Europe. It goes along with the oldest question of Europe. When will the next war start, and where will it be fought? The unification of Germany led to the unification of Germany led to the 31 years. For 45 years, Germany was divided, and there was peace. Now Germany is united again, and it is unquestionably the leading power of Europe. If the European Union fails and its collaborative structure breaks, then the question is whether the Europe that tore itself apart will return to its prior structure." And then he goes on to talk about how, again, Germany is the most powerful country in Europe today. The decisions it makes is going to have much greater effect on the European peninsula. Its unification in 1871 changed the way Europe worked, creating a massive, creative and insecure power at the center of the European plane. And then it talked about how Germany originated from fragmentation, was repeatedly crushed and reshaped and continually re-emerged, not just as a country, but as the leading country in Europe. Part of this simply has to do with geography, writes Friedman. Any country located in the middle of the northern plain of Europe will be important, whether fragmented, as it was during the Holy Roman Empire, or united. But its repeated re-emergence as the leading power of Europe is a more complex matter. And then he goes on to talk about that. But Germany is the leading power of Europe. And Germany, its geography, a whole load of other things about it dictate that it is going to remain the leading power of Europe no matter what happens to the European Union. So no matter what happens to the EU, there will be a group of nations that all look to Germany for leadership. In other words, Britain is going to face a united power in Europe, whether it leaves the EU or whether it stays, whether the EU falls apart or sticks together. And throughout history, like we were talking in the previous segment, a united power in Europe has always been a threat to the UK. Always. And history is not over. That has not changed now. And so whether Britain stays or goes, as I said, there's going to be a group of nations centered around Germany, dominating Europe. And this is something that just about every serious analyst out there can agree on, regardless of their personal opinion as to whether the EU will crumble or whether it will unify. That's coming regardless of whether Britain stays or goes. And that's exactly what the Bible prophesies, a Holy Roman Empire dominated by Germany. But the Bible says there'll be 10 nations around it, 10 kings who will give up their power to this power. But it's not going to be completely unified. The book of Daniel chapter 2, makes the analogy that this power will be like iron mixed with clay. There shall be in it the strength of iron, it says, but it says that the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. It says, whereas you saw iron mixed with clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to one another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. So there'll be 10 kings, 10 nations or blocks of nations in this coming European power. Currently, but they're not going to be entirely unified, and currently there are 28. Now already that tells you there's going to be some big changes coming to Europe for it to go from 28 to 10. And so those people who say the 28-nation EU, it's too big, it's too unwieldy, it will never get anything done, those people are right. There will be probably some kind of falling apart of the European Union, or alternatively, there'll be a group of 10 nations that will move beyond the EU and their cooperation. Maybe the EU will fall apart and these nations will come together out of the ashes. But big changes are coming to Europe, and just speculation, but maybe a Brexit could even precipitate those changes. But even when it's just those 10 nations, it's still an iron and clay union. It's fragile. They don't mix well. And even that falls apart within a few dozen months or less. Now, I haven't covered any news articles yet, so get one news article quickly. Guy Verhofstadt, he leads the liberal group in the European Parliament. He's one of the more liberal MEPs. And he was talking to the EU Observer about how, whether Britain stays or goes, it's still going to lead to a more unified Europe. The whole discussion and referendum around Britain's membership is an opportunity, he said. Why? Because if it is a no, we need to start negotiations. If it is a yes, we agreed with David Cameron to translate the special status for Britain into the treaty. And he promised not to make obstacles for the deepening of the union. And so then the EU Observer writes, no matter what the result of the British referendum on the 23rd of June, it will lead to change in the European architecture, Verhofstadt said. Either the British stay in the EU, but let the rest of it become a real union, he explained, or it exits the EU, letting it become a real union. And he's right. You know, that is one scenario. It doesn't necessarily happen that way, but sooner or later, this European power is coming. And so that's what's coming. Just a sober analysis of world affairs tells us. Germany dominates Europe. With or without the EU, a group of nations are going to be drawn into Germany's orbit. And this analysis confirms what the Bible says. And then the Bible adds more detail. There'll be 10 nations. There'll be 5 of these nations will be in the east, 5 in the west, for example. Now, the article that I mentioned at the start from Mr. Armstrong talking about how the day that Britain joined the EU was a tragically historic day. These prophecies are exactly what then the bulk of that article goes on to explain and goes on to talk about. And as he explained in that other article we quoted, Britain has been looking to that power, this rising European power, for help instead of to God. And it hasn't solved Britain's problems. So much so that 30 years later, the nation is having a referendum. 40 years later, I guess, the nation is having a referendum. And even the people voting to stay in, even most of those people, they don't like the European Union. It's just a bit like the choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in America. They see it as the least bad option. They don't necessarily like the European Union, but they're worried about the economic consequences of leaving. So Britain looking to Europe for help has clearly failed. It has not solved those problems and it's introduced problems of its own. But Bible prophecy says Britain will keep on looking to Germany, keep on looking to Europe to solve its problems, and it's going to get badly burned doing that. But there is good news here, and we always try to emphasize that at the trumpet and in our articles. And the good news is God is allowing the rise of this European power, this power that's going to threaten Britain and even America. He is allowing the rise of that power to teach the whole world that there is no hope except to look to God, the way Britain has so far failed to do. He wants everyone to know that in his time. And that is what the rise of Europe, the rise of this 10-nation power in Europe is all about. God is getting ready to teach the whole world to look to him. If you want to know more about what we've been talking about today, read Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain and Prophecy, as you heard in one of the ad breaks on this program. That's about it from me today. Tomorrow you have the opportunity to hear from Brent Nachtigall, our correspondent over there in Israel. He will be presenting that program. Definitely be worth tuning in. Keep on listening to KPCG and tune in tomorrow for Trumpet Daily Radio.